Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Thelonious Monk had a genius for jazz, for unusual and daring composition, for confounding and delighting the world. From the 1940s to the 1970s and beyond, the myth of Monk nearly overshadowed the man. But his music rolls on this hour On Point, a deep new look at the great jazz man Thelonious Monk with biographer Robin Kelly. You can join the conversation. Has Monk moved you? Why? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. A little later in this hour, we have the pleasure of, or will have the pleasure of, hearing from the great contemporary American jazz pianist Matthew Shipp on Monk. But first, joining us from Los Angeles is Robin Kelly, professor of history and American studies at the University of Southern California. He's author of Race Rebels and Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination. His new biography is Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original. Robin Kelly, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom. I really appreciate being here.
Well, it's a terrific and really comprehensive book. And you've got this great summary at the end of it. We want to dive into Monk's life. But you see Thelonious Monk in what you call a tradition of sonic disturbance. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because people sometimes connect that line to hip-hop and other kinds of contemporary musics. Mm-hmm. Monk wasn't one to allow the rivers of music to continue. He sort of disrupted the flow. And when he appeared on the scene in the early 1940s, his whole conception of harmony and rhythm in his angular melodies were so different from what other people were playing that he really disturbed both the senses of critics and, you know, shocked a lot of musicians. And, you know, you either loved him or you hated him, you know. And it took a while before the kind of critical establishment could kind of catch up to what he was doing. And I think that one of my concerns is that in this age of canonization, we tend to put Monk and other great artists in a kind of a museum, mm-hmm. away from seeing how rebellious they were musically and artistically.
You know, I love this music. We want to learn about the man and the elements of his life that may have been pouring out in this music, but we want to hear the music as we do it. We've got a track here from Monk. This is three-person ensemble, 1947 song, Introspection. We're going to play it. Tell us a little bit about it before we let it roll, Robin Kelly.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite Monk songs, actually.
Mine too.
It was first recorded in 47, but wasn't released on Blue Note label for another decade, mm-hmm. in part because I think they thought it was too adventurous. And unlike so many songs in that era that took the chord changes of a standard Tin Pan Alley song, Monk created a whole new architecture for this song that built on what musicians would call a whole tone scale, and that is you had no sense of a kind of tonic grounding. And so what's wonderful about the song, it kind of floats, and it has strange number of bars, and it ends on a note that's not the note you began with, which is called the tonic. It ends on a different note. Mm. So it gives you that sort of free floating feeling.
Let's get right on that keyboard or floating above it. Thelonious Monk, Introspection. Robin Kelly, I want to hear this last note. Don't let us talk over it, but this word angular always comes up when people talk about Monk's playing. Are you hearing it right there?
Yeah. You hear it, especially in the melody.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's, you know, by angular, you know, it's not that it's necessarily dissonant, but rhythmically it falls in different places, and it tricks the ear in some ways. You know, it takes you away from symmetry. You know, we're so used to symmetry in so much of art, but he's interested in asymmetry in some ways.
We love it. August Kleinzahler said in the Times, it's an angular, splintered sound, percussive in attack and asymmetrical, music that always manages to swing hard and respect the melody.
Absolutely.
He wasn't leaving melody behind. In that way, he's an old school guy.
That is so correct. It's amazing how he would take the melody and move it, twist it, rearrange it, and always stay right there. It's sort of like the old-fashioned New Orleans musicians or even those Harlem Stride pianists of the 1920s. They loved the melody.
I guess we're not going to get the last note, so I won't make us wait for it. I regret that. We just don't have it. I wanted to get to that no tonic grounding point with you.
Right.
But we will. Tell us, for listeners who don't know, Thelonious Monk, we'll come to where he came from, but I guess in part what you're being lauded for here is teasing apart the man and the myth, and that is very hard to do because the myth of Monk was so enormous and so beguiling. Everybody kind of loved the myth. Set that out for us so we can understand what you're telling us in maybe opposition or distinction to that, Robin. What was the myth that grew up around him?
Sure. The key myths were that he was disconnected from reality. He was very taciturn, reclusive, and that he lived inside of his head, inside of his music. Sometimes that myth is attributed to his what we know now is bipolar disorder, mm-hmm. or manic depression. In those days, they called schizophrenia. They called all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that myth is tied to this idea that Monk is sort of an eccentric figure. And, you know, I'm not here to say that he wasn't unusual or unique or original, but he was less eccentric and certainly not reclusive. He loved his family. He was very much a community guy. You know, he grew up in the west side of Manhattan, West 63rd Street, just west of where Lincoln Center is now. And he was someone who was very much a part of his community center. He had very good friends who was well-respected. And his music comes not out of some, you know, internal struggle, some kind of mental disorder, a lack of skill, nor does it come from just sort of an overactive imagination. It comes out of very hard work and an understanding from study of harmony, rhythm, of traditions of American music and European music. And one of the other myths about Monk is that he wasn't trained, that he somehow was self-taught, almost described as a kind of idiot savant who had kind mm-hmm. of a brilliance to him. But Monk had many teachers, and I talk about those teachers in some detail in the book. And I also talk about what he learned from various schools of thought, from the old Harlem Stride pianists to the bebop musicians around him, to just, you know, listening to classical music.
Let's hear Round Midnight. We'll talk more about where this all came from. Here's kind of a jazz anthem, and it all began with Thelonious Monk. Monk, Round Midnight, there's quite a story with it. We've got a caller here already just on this piece. Let's go to Irene, Brookline, Massachusetts. Irene, you're on the air. Hello. Irene. Hi, Irene,
oh,
you're
wow.
on.
Oh, wow.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm delighted you're having a program on Monk and his life. And, you know, it's funny because Round Midnight was the piece that my daughter, who's a jazz musician, Grace Kelly, was listening when she was little. Stan Getz playing it and was inspired by that piece. And even now when she's touring all over the world, she plays that piece, especially with the bass. She does a duo almost every concert because this is her favorite ballad of all time. And I think it's like the top jazz covered composition. Now, my question is, I think he wrote it when he was like 18, Monk. And there are also intro and outro to the song, and there are other composers like Dizzy Gillespie, who's also names associated with that piece. So I'm just curious about how the whole piece, even though it's a Monk piece, we get... there's a credit for other.
It's a great story, Irene.
Yes.
And Robin Kelly just got a half a minute before the break, but the bass of it, he was how old? And then he didn't perform it first.
Oh, he was actually a little older than that. Mm-hmm. The song was originally called I Need You So, mm-hmm. and he copyrighted 1943. Mm. Later, it was picked up. And that's a story I hope we can go back to because it's worth telling. And I just have to say, it's such an honor to have the mother of Grace Kelly calling in because, you know, your daughter is incredibly talented. And this song has been a challenge to jazz musicians all over the globe and continues to be.
Hold that Round Midnight story then, and we'll hear it after we come back from a short break. Robin Kelly is with us today from Los Angeles. We're just delighted to have him. He's got a great new biography out, Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original. And listeners, you are very welcome as well here. Do you know Monk? Did you grow up with him in the clubs, on the cover of Time magazine? And have you found Monk more recently with Round Midnight, Straight No Chaser, Crepuscule, with Nelly, Introspection, you name it. We've got evidence behind us right here now. 1948, July, New York City. Join us, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're talking about Thelonious Monk. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Behind us right there, Trinkle Tinkle, Thelonious Monk. His biographer, Robin Kelly, joins us today from Los Angeles. A great new biography, Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original. A jazz great, looks at his music, his path-breaking music, his life. It is quite something to hear. You can join the conversation today. Did you grow up with the exotic monk? As your understanding, eccentric, reclusive, erratic, intuitive, brooding. And how do you hear Robin Kelly's Monk? Just a working musician trying to get by? Really? What's the magic of Monk? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're going to hear in a few minutes from the great contemporary pianist Matthew Shipp, very much a kind of, in the line of Thelonious Monk, and we want to hear more about Round Midnight, but let's get a call first from Jeffersonville, Vermont, and Zach. Zach, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, just wanted to say it's great to hear this show about Monk and that this new biography has been written. I've been a fan for a long time. I am a musician and just have always felt a deep connection with his music for some reason. It's really cool to... Yep.
To hear it and have it right here, you and a lot of others. Zach, thanks for being there. Robin Kelly, we've got so much to look at here. But the Round Midnight story, as you say, is very instructive about who this was and how
Absolutely.
He sort of intersected with the music world and ended up feeling about it.
Right. No, it's a really great story, and I'm proud to say that my book was the first one to really lay it out. The song was titled I Need You So, and he actually worked with a lyricist who lived in his neighborhood, a black woman named Thelma Elizabeth Murray, and she wrote lyrics. They copyrighted the song in 1943. Nothing happened with that. So Monk was writing it in his early 20s, about 21, 22. At 23 years old, that's when he submitted a copyright. And a year later, nothing happened with it. Cootie Williams, a band leader who was working with Bud Powell, the pianist, Bud said, look, Cootie, you need to play this song, this great song that by that time Monk was calling Round Midnight. And Cootie Williams decided to include it in his repertoire, and like a lot of band leaders, he copyrighted it with his name as a co-composer. And then lyrics were added later by a man named Bernie Hanigan. So by 1945, there were three composers attached to this one song, Bernie Hanigan, Cootie Williams, and Thelonious Monk.
And then Dizzy Gillespie records it before Monk does.
Oh, Dizzy Gillespie records it before Monk. Cootie Williams records it before Monk. Bud was with Cootie when he recorded it with before Monk. By the time Monk records it, in the recording that you played from Blue Note, this is the first time Monk recorded. This is 3 years, 4 years after he first copyrighted the song in 1947. And that particular version, interestingly enough, even Leonard Feather, the great jazz critic, said Cootie Williams' version of Round Midnight is far superior to Monk's.
Wow. How did he feel about that whole path? I mean, he was very young, but not that young.
He wasn't that young. And, you know, it was certainly painful for Monk. And what Monk does in that particular arrangement is that he improvises while the horns play the melody. Mm-hmm. And this is something Monk loved to do, you know, have the horns play kind of these dissonant chords. And he loved that sound, and the critics did not like it. In fact, they took him to task for that in the 40s when he released that record. And yet, to this day, you know, Round Midnight is one of the most distinctive jazz compositions in around the world. You know, everyone plays it. And Dizzy Gillespie's intro, which actually was a piece that he used as a cadence for another song, also became very much a part of the composition. And Monk himself continued to use Dizzy's introduction.
We're going to hear from, talk about distinctive, we're going to hear from a very distinctive pianist in just a moment here, a kind of heir to a great tradition. But let's get a little more Monk in our ears. This is Brilliant Corners, Thelonious Monk, 1956, from the album Brilliant Corners. Maybe one of the most difficult and rewarding recording sessions behind this of Monk's career. Smuck and Quintet there with Brilliant Corners from 1956. Robin Kelly is with us from Los Angeles, author of the new biography, Thelonious Monk. And with us right now from New York City, and we're honored to have him, Matthew Shipp, leading American jazz pianist, composer, and band leader. His new solo piano album, which comes out in January, is called 4D. Pioneer in pushing jazz forward into free jazz and avant-garde styles, incorporating hip-hop, electronic music. Matthew Shipp, it's such an honor to have you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Talk to us about Thelonious Monk and his music and the role it may have played in developing your own musical ear and style.
First of all, I just want to say thanks to Robin for this tremendous, tremendous biography. Mm. It's really one of the great jazz biographies ever written, and it fleshes out many aspects of Thelonious's career and life and really paints a portrait of him as a human being other than just a myth.
Thank you.
You know, the thing about Monk that I find really interesting, and Robin talks about this in the book, and you introduced me as an avant-garde pianist, which I usually just think of myself as a modern musician.
Very good.
but anyway, it's kind of Monk's paradoxical relationship with that music, because now about three or four generations of pianists have claimed Monk as a major influence, and he kind of had a very bizarre relationship with the new music. Now, first of all, obviously he's an innovator of the highest order, and his music was very shocking and new at his time, so he was cast, you know, as an avant-gardist, even though a lot of what he does is based in very deep tradition, such as a stride pianist and the whole tradition of jazz piano leading up to him, including swing elements, you know, from Duke Ellington and Count Basie, whatever. But there's a whole generation right after him that found his example of his own belief in himself, his own kind of iconoclastic way of dealing with the music, and his, you know, just very solid belief in his own ideas and his willingness to pursue them to the very end with utter persistence. And without really being, I wouldn't say he didn't care. He obviously cared what people think, because, you know, he's, as Robbins would say, he was looking for a hit. But he also had this just dogged determination to follow his own ideas to the end and not compromise. And a whole generation of pianists after that were really, really kind of influenced by Monk's whole way of being in that way. And, you know, the names are pretty familiar to people that follow the music of the people that that really took Monk's example to heart. In my case, I would say I'm like a third or fourth generation of pianists that was really touched by Monk's discipline, his belief in himself, and his just human, the humanness in his music. I mean, his music is obviously an Afro-American, you know, a jazz music, but at the same time, it kind of, he has just such an open mind that he takes in everything and kind of just takes, you know, he kind of takes everything in and brings it into his own idiom, where he kind of really discovered what the essence of what makes him work as a composer and a pianist. And he was able to just really develop this music that was his vision. So I think that just that type of thing has really influenced, you know, me and many other pianists. And when I say a third or fourth generation, if you look at the first generation of people right after Monk, people like Randy Weston or Mal Waldron or Cecil Taylor, you know, then you go to a later generation, people like, I'm going to skip ahead a little bit, but like Anthony Davis, and then my generation, myself, people like Jason Moran. The figure of Monk is just a very pervasive figure. And also, he also gives kind of an alternative to, because when you become a jazz pianist, I can speak for my generation, usually when you're very young, the first person you hear like is Oscar Peterson.
Right.
And Oscar Peterson is, you know, seen as coming out of Art Tatum and maybe Nat Cole and others. And there's kind of a, how could I put this, a technical cul-de-sac. If you follow Peterson's example to his logical end, I don't think there's really anywhere to go with it. But Monk offers an infinity of responses.
Absolutely.
And I think to me that's what any great artist does, offers an infinity of responses for future generations to be influenced.
Wow, what a great phrase. Matthew Shipp, if you'd be good enough to stand by for just a second, I'd like to drop in here a bit of one of your pieces. This is Equilibrium from 2002, just to get Robin Kelly sort of thinking about the resonance between Monk and now. Matthew Shipp, here's Equilibrium. Matthew Shipp's Equilibrium. Robin Kelly, you're the great biographer now, Thelonious Monk. Can you hear the line of descent there, sir?
Oh, absolutely. And this is why I name Matthew Shipp among a group of pianists at the end of the book, of those who kind of come out of Monk, not because Matthew or others sound like Monk, but because they took the basic ideas and really did do what he said, play yourself. I mean, you know, Matthew has such an original sound. And I have to say, one of my all-time favorite songs, period, is his cover of Autumn Leaves, which I must have listened to for a good 12 hours straight, over and over again. And yet, you know, you could hear, again, I don't think I couldn't have said it better in terms of Matthew's own description of what Monk was trying to do, but also what people take from him. I mean, you think about pianists as kind of a line of descent. You know, the great ones are not the ones who sound like someone, but who could take who can build their own language from all these traditions. The genre distinctions that we have inherited, you know, like avant-garde, bebop, post-bop, mm-hmm. they all break down because, you know, all these musicians absorb all of it and synthesize it and create something that is an original voice, and yet you could hear echoes of all those traditions through the music.
Matthew Shipp, if I may ask you a very kind of intimate question. I don't know if you'll hear it that way or not. Maybe it's just workaday craftsmanship to you, but when you listen to Monk and you hear what people, you know, describe as that angular, splintered, percussive, asymmetrical, yes, you see the traditions and hear the traditions it's coming from, but as a musician, I mean, you yourself, you know, the New York Times has called you a true American eccentric, and that part of what people put on Monk, where we hear the eccentricism, do you hear that as a musical tradition or as something more broadly cultural or psychological or personal, or even in Monk's case, he battled with bipolar situation, even pathological elements? How do you hear it, if you don't mind my asking?
There's a lot of them. Yeah, I mean, there. What you just said right there. There's a lot of parts of that, and you know, if you go into each part, it could be like a whole half hour.
Yes, sorry. Pick your favorite. But
I think personal style is always a matter of a lot of different constituents. I would say that there was a tradition of modernism, if you want to call it that, already in jazz with Duke Ellington. Now I know, even though Thelonious worshiped Duke, he never claimed him as an influence, and I don't know, you know, I wasn't there, I don't know what he listened to but I would also say that somebody's central nervous system definitely enters into the contours of what they play. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you actually would cut into somebody's central nervous system, you would see every reason for every little flourish they do on the instrument, with somebody as distinctive a style as Monk. And, you know, especially since his whole thing, his body, his mind, and his spirit were rooted together in one conceptual unit. And the whole dance he did when he played and got up, you know, is showing that.
With the band, or even from the piano, he'd get up and just groove.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I would say, as part of what you said, A, he just had a personal vision. B, he's living in New York City and soaking in the rhythms of the city, the architecture, everything, and being at such an open mind that just soaked in everything. You know, the jagged architecture, the jagged rhythms of the city, will affect his subconscious mind. C, he had a modernist bent just because he was in tune with his world. D, I do personally think that, you know, whatever was going on in his nervous system, which I would say this about any musician, affects their product and their process. And so I, you know, when you talk about a personal style, many constituent elements go in to create that. And nobody can sit back and say this one element and this one element made this what the product is, but we all know what the stew is that goes into making it. And I think all the things you mentioned are a part of Monk's psychic world.
Matthew Shipp, you're a treasure, and you're very generous to spend a few minutes with us today on another pianist, however great. But wonderful to have you. It's an honor. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks. And one thing about Rob, can I say about the book? I know Randy Weston not very well, but when I run into him, I talk to him. I knew he was around, and you think of Randy Weston as a being influenced by Monk, but I never knew he was such an intricate part of a lot of decisions, like introducing Monk to people. You know, sometimes introducing him to musicians that later became in the band. It was kind of really an eye opener, just because Randy's so he's so humble.
Yes, that's true.
Matthew Shipp, pianist, composer, band leader, it's an honor to have you with us today from New York City. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Robin Kelly is the author of the new Thelonious Monk biography, Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original. We go out right here with In Walked Bud, as in Bud Powell. There's a story behind that as well. We'll come back and hear it. Listeners, you can join us. What's the magic of Monk? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Thank you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about jazz great Thelonious Monk, his life and his path-breaking music, with biographer Robin Kelly, just out with his definitive Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original. We've heard some amazing jazz already in this hour. We will hear more, but there's more than jazz in the life story of this man. There's sacred music, life with a traveling evangelist during his teens, his mother's influence. I want to play right here, and this one can bring you to tears. This is from the sort of gospel or sacred tradition, Thelonious Monk, in an entirely different vein. This is a song recorded in 1966 on his album Monk Alone, the sacred song, This Is My Story, This Is My Song. We'll play the whole thing. Thelonious Monk, This Is My Story, This Is My Song, from Monk Alone, 1966. Robin Kelly, I have to say, I had that on in the car last night. I had to pull over. That just It just pulled me up short. I had not heard, I'd heard plenty of the jazz, but I hadn't heard it before. Where did that come from?
Yeah. I mean, people who know the kind of Christian tradition would recognize that as Blessed Assurance, but Monk is very old school. Like a lot of the gospel pianists, They would call songs by the first line, You know. And in his career, he recorded at least three sacred songs. In the Christian tradition, of course, you know, Blessed Assurance, or what we just heard, He recorded Abide With Me. He wrote a beautiful arrangement for just horns. I mean, imagine you got John Coltrane and Coleman Hawkins and G.G. Grice playing this wonderful song that he grew up with. And the third song was We'll Understand It Better By and By, a gospel hymn by the great Reverend Charles Tinley that he wrote turn of the century. And Monk knew this repertoire for a couple of reasons. One, his mother, before she converted to Jehovah's Witness, was a dyed-in-wool Baptist who played a little piano and taught Thelonious a lot of these songs, these gospel hymns and whatnot. In fact, sometimes Monk would come to the church that his mother attended, Barbara Monk, and play for her while she sang, while he was a teenager.
This the mother who had brought Thelonious and his siblings up from North Carolina.
Exactly, exactly. His three children altogether, Thelonious, his sister Marion, and brother Thomas. The other thing is that through his mother, a friend of his mother's, when Thelonious was a teenager, he went on the road with a female evangelist who is out of the Pentecostal holiness tradition, and she was a faith healer. And they traveled around the Midwest, part of the South and Southwest, for about 2 years, playing at various churches, tent revivals. And he really kind of mastered this repertoire. And what's interesting about the Pentecostal tradition is, it's as much as the Pentecostals, you know, sort of avoid what they consider to be jazz or secular music, it had more jazz inflections, you know, more syncopation.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where he comes out of that.
It's unspeakably beautiful. Talk to us, if you would, about two other, maybe the two women of his life, Nellie, his wife, and then the Baroness. Introduce them, if you would.
Right. Well, let's begin with Nellie, the love of his life. Thelonious only had three girlfriends in his whole life, and all three lived within a two-block radius.
Wow.
He was so community-oriented, and his first Chodorine Wilson ended up marrying his brother, Thomas. Mm-hmm. His second, Rupi Richardson, of West Indian descent, lived a couple blocks away, and they never got married, but he fell in love with her. And for her, he wrote Ruby, My Dear. And Nellie, just to show you how close they were, Nellie was the younger sister of his best friend, Sonny. Mm-hmm. They grew up together. Nellie met Thelonious when she was about 11 years old, and he was 15. And, you know, it took some time, but once they got together, Nellie really was his muse, and it was a lifelong love affair that lasted, you know, until his death. And to me, you know, given the stories of infidelity that we identify with, you know, musicians and being on the road, mm-hmm. I found no evidence of that. And she was more than just a helpmate, more than just a critic of the music. She became his road manager. At some point, she was hiring and firing musicians. She really took care of Thelonious and did a great job taking care of her two children.
He died in her arms in 1982. But then there's the other great story, platonic, I guess, but nevertheless, mm-hmm. of Baroness, and I'm not sure how she brought the pronouncer to this country, but this is Nika de Koningswarte.
Exactly. And that is the other, I would say, great love, though it was completely platonic. Mm. He met Nika in 1954 in Paris.
This is the Rothschild, the wife of a French ambassador to Peru,
exactly.
or something, big money.
Exactly, big money. Although when she and Jules de Koningswarte divorced, she had some money, but, you know, she wasn't as wealthy. In other words, she was cut off from some connections to sort of the Rothschild empire. And
but
she paid
a 30-something room house in Weehawken, New Jersey.
Oh, it wasn't 30-something.
Okay.
It actually wasn't that big.
Oh,
It's about altogether, depending what you count as a bedroom, maybe a 5-bedroom house.
Oh.
It's a modest, beautiful house with a wonderful view.
Mm-hmm.
And she drove a Bentley and then a Rolls Royce. But she was a patron of basically the whole music. She loved and supported jazz musicians, and Thelonious was her favorite. It's important to establish that Nika had a very close relationship to Nellie.
Mm-hmm.
That Monk and Nellie would go over to Nika's house, hang out, sometimes spend the night. When Thelonious could no longer really make it without sort of daily care, and he eventually moved in with the Baroness,
mm-hmm.
Nellie was over there just about every day, cooking for him, taking care of him. And the two of them together worked to make sure that Thelonious was comfortable and had what he needed. And I have a great story in the book where, you know, Monk uses his relationship to Nika to school one of his sidemen to say, look, if you have a friend, you don't want to sleep with her, you don't want to have anything that's close to a sexual relationship, because if you do that, you lose her as a friend.
Wow.
Like me, I would never touch Nika.
Mm.
And he said that, you know. And yet the myth is that they had this, you know, whether it's a liaison or
mm-hmm.
That it was a sort of hot and heavy relationship, which, of course, fuels speculation about the two of them.
Sure. With your permission, I would love to read a little bit from, I hadn't known until reading you here, that he was on the cover of Time magazine in 1964. I want to talk about that, mm-hmm. but there's a little bit in this very long piece, Thelonious Monk on the cover of Time, think of it, in 1964, headlined The Loneliest Monk, and they write it up like this about the two women and Thelonious Monk. Nellie, that's his wife, spends a hysterical hour every evening getting him into his ensemble. and when he steps out the door, he looks faintly like an Oriental garden, subtle colors echoing back and forth, prim suits and silk shirts glimmering discreetly. He spends hours standing around with his band, talking in his unpenetrable oracular mode. Always no, always night, always no, and dig the way I say always, he says, smiling mysteriously. There's some of your mythos. When he's playing anywhere near New York, the Baroness comes to drive him home, and they fly off in the Bentley, content in the knowledge that there is no one remotely like either one of them under the sun. The car pulls up to Monk's Block. He skips out and disappears into his old $39 a month apartment. The Baroness drives home to Weehawken. Wow, that's an incredible picture. Is that the myth? Is that what you're pushing against? Or did that piece of this catch him pretty well?
Well, you know, that's part of the myth. But, you know, I also make the argument that Thelonious was very well aware of the story circulating about him. And there are times, as he told Frank Lyndon Brown, the journalist and writer, said there are times when, it basically benefits you for people to think you're crazy. They leave you alone. And Monk was a showman. I mean, he was a showman. He was show business. And so when Barry Farrow, who wrote that piece about Time Magazine, followed mm-hmm. him around for several months, Thelonious was very much aware what Farrow was doing. He wanted to give him some copy, give him something exciting. You could see the same thing. If you ever see the film Straight No Chaser, mm-hmm. it's actually a recut. It's two other films that were done in the late 60s by German filmmakers Christian and Michael Blackwood, and Straight No Chaser is basically a recut version of their films. But there are moments when he's in the airport and he's spinning around mm-hmm. and he's looking in the camera. He's doing that for the camera. He's, you know, and I talked to Michael Blackwood, and he's doing that because he is performing for the camera. And yet we walk away from that as if it's a candid shot and we're capturing the true Monk in his eccentric sort of, you know, disconnection.
Yeah. I've got a little tape. He's performing. I've got a little tape of him. And this is a 1963 interview at the New School in New York City. Monk was asked who he wanted to reach with his music. Thelonious Monk.
I'd like to reach everybody, the public plus the musicians. I mean, that's how a standard that I set for my songs. I mean, that something that will get to the people's ear, plus no criticism from the musicians.
Thelonious Monk in his own words. And here he is, 1959, from the album Five by Monk by Five with Jackie Ng. Let's get a call from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Terry, you're on the air with Robin Kelly, Thelonious Monk biographer.
Hey, how you doing? I just want to say, you know, Monk's music has, like, really changed my life, but with the album Monk's Dream that I discovered when I was really young. And as a writer, I use jazz and Monk's music to sort of shape whatever direction I'm going in. But I had a question. I heard I've never read a formal biography. I heard a myth that in his later years, he would sort of critique and teach other musicians, like, from his bed. Like, they would come into his room, and he would listen to what they were doing and sort of give them notes on it. And I just want to know if there was any merit behind that. And I just want to say I'm really excited to read the book.
Thank you, Terry. Robin Kelly, Monk from Bed. What about it?
Yes, in fact, there is merit to that. The two things. One, Monk was very much a teacher. So even if he was in or out of bed, he worked with so many young musicians from the 1940s up until he no longer was interested in playing. But the other thing is that the bed was his home, and it was a kind of a semi-public space. You know, the kids, Nelly, all of them would be in the bed watching television, playing Yahtzee. Mm. Musicians would come over and sit and talk with them while he lays down, you know. And so for him, it was an inviting space, and his apartment was so small that, you know, it wasn't much of a step between his bedroom and where the piano was in the kitchen.
He lost his cabaret card just around the time of the piece Jackie Ng we're hearing right there, was beaten terribly by police in Delaware, struggled with with his mental situation at the end of his life, what about that? You know, why did he withdraw, and was that the bipolar problem taking him down at the end?
Right. Well, I guess there are two questions there. One has to do with what happened right after. You know, by the time he made this recording in 1959, he didn't have a cabaret card for a third time. And
was it a drug bust that time, or?
No, it actually, he was traveling in through Delaware.
That's right.
On his way to a gig in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And he stopped at a motel for a glass of water. And Monk himself wasn't feeling too well. Mm-hmm. You know, he was sort of on the verge of one of his episodes. And and Delaware was somewhat segregated in those days. Mm-hmm. And so the owner of the motel said, look, you know, I can't really help you. I can't serve you, and was threatened by his very presence, mm-hmm. called the police, and to make a long story short, the police arrested the Baroness who was driving, Thelonious Monk, and his saxophone player, Charlie Rouse, who was also in the car with them. Mm-hmm. And part of it has to do with you have a white woman driving these two black men mm-hmm. through Delaware in a Bentley. mm-hmm. And so he ended up, the Baroness was arrested for possession of marijuana. Monk himself was fined for basically disturbing the peace. It really mm-hmm. comes down to that. The charges against him were dropped, but it really didn't matter because the New York PD decided to take away his cabaret card again, you know, for a third time, and he didn't work till 1960.
It was not an easy life, but it left an incredible, incredible record of music. And you brought the life story and the music together so beautifully in this biography. And I'm afraid we're out of time with that, and I regret it. I could go another hour or two. Robin Kelly, it's just great. Great, great biography, and great to have you with us this hour. Thank you so much for spending, 16 years delving into Thelonious Monk?
About that. Thank you, Tom. I really appreciate it.
Well, bravo to you. Thanks for being here today. Listeners, thank you for joining us. We'll go out with one more Well You Needn't, Thelonious Monk, 1957, from Monk's Music. Well, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.